This is Radio Boston. I'm Carrie Goldberg.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Guess you better slow than Mustang Down. All right, it's a great old song. We love an excuse to play a song like that. This version of Mustang Sally is one of the highlights from the soundtrack of the film The Commitments. Alan Parker's movie, of course, was based on the first novel by the Irish writer Roddy Doyle.
Doyle wrote it 27 years ago, telling the story of young Jimmy Rabbit, who takes a bunch of working-class Dubliners and transforms them into a great band of soul singers. The book tells the story of the band, its sudden success, and rapid demise.
Since then, Roddy Doyle has published more than 10 other books, including Patty Clark, Ha Ha Ha, which won the Booker Prize in 1993. In his latest novel, The Guts, Jimmy Rabbit is back. He's reached his late 40s, he's married with four kids, and he managed to launch a relatively successful music company.
But life's a lot more complicated for Jimmy, thanks to the usual stuff that many people of a certain age have to deal with, including family responsibilities, a recession, and cancer. Cancer of the bowel, to be precise.
So, facing his own mortality, Rabbit reconnects with his past, including his long-lost brother and two members of the Commitments. And joining me now is the novelist, dramatist, screenwriter Roddy Doyle. He's in Boston to promote his new novel, The Guts, and Roddy Doyle, welcome to Radio Boston. It's a great pleasure to have you.
Thank you very much.
And I'm loving your book. I'm loving The Guts, and I've been a big fan of your writing for a while. Listeners, what's your question for Roddy Doyle, author of The Commitments and now The Guts, among many other books? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at Radio Boston. So, Roddy Doyle, let me ask you about how you view the predicament that the hero Jimmy Rabbit faces in this new book. This could be a somber set of circumstances that afflict him, but he doesn't let the cancer take him down. It seems to sort of inspire almost like a second act in his life. But
yeah, I suppose the challenge really, I gave him cancer during a recession, which is a double whammy really. So I was kind of, I drop him in that and say, climb your way out of that, you know? And he successfully does. Not the Irish economy is still in a mess, but he overcomes the cancer. And I suppose, in a way, what I was trying to do was, use my own life experience. I haven't had cancer, but I've had friends who have had it, and one or two who have died, and others who've survived. And it becomes a topic of conversation when you reach your late 40s, I remember correctly. It's added to football and music and children and, you know, work when you meet friends in the pub. And I was surrounding myself, if you like, with these daily humiliations, getting older all the time, grunting when you go out to pick up something, which is utterly forgetting to button your fly, stuff like that. Small little humiliations that accumulate just to really slowly.
I know, and accumulate is the right word, right?
So I thought, well, I'll give all this to Jimmy and just see what his attitude is. Is he going to lie down and literally die? Or is he going to lie down and, you know, figuratively die? Or is he just going to fight it, you know? Is he going to, you know, make the most of what he has? Or is he, you know, so this is what he does. I suppose the challenge really as a writer whose outlook is largely comic, my own, the challenge is to, you know, try to write a funny book about a man with cancer during the recession.
Well, you've succeeded because there is so much humor and heart in this book. Because Jimmy, it seems like he really decides almost to live more for the moment, to take up a new instrument, to connect with people in the past. I mean, did you imagine that this was the route he was going to take? Because you talk about sort of throwing these circumstances at him and seeing how he would deal with them, like you weren't sure.
I don't plan too meticulously. Yeah. I knew he was going to survive. I knew that was you know, one of my definite decisions. And I knew I was going to send him to this big rock festival. Right. The Electric Picnic, which takes place every year in late August in the Midlands of Ireland. And again, I go to that myself, so I was doing my homework. I didn't have to research what is a rock festival and what happens there.
Yeah.
So I didn't plan, you know, he decides to learn to play the trumpet. His wife gives him a Christmas present after he's been diagnosed with cancer. And this trumpet, it's at the end of the bed. It's a beautiful thing. He's never played an instrument, you know, which is a strange one, given that he's formed bands and he works in the film industry. or not the film, the music industry. And this is the tiny bit of autobiography that's there, because I bought a trumpet and decided I'd learn how to play it.
So did you do it relatively late in life or midlife?
I did it while I was writing this book.
Oh, good for you.
But what happened was, the man I bought the trumpet from, I bought it in January. He very sweetly said, you know, when I was taking it away, he said, you'll be playing tunes by Christmas. And I thought, oh, that's nice. But it struck me then, wouldn't that be a lovely thing for Jimmy to hear his wife say when she gives him the trumpet at Christmas?
Is nice. Well, so how did it work for you, just out of curiosity? Were you playing the trumpet by June?
I can play tunes badly. You know what I love playing particularly is the end of Hey Jude. You know, because I can pretend I played it all, but I do the da 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 da, da, and it makes. I work in the attic of my house, and I open the attic. The dogs outside start barking, but it's a great thing. I started playing because my wife said I was snoring, and she did a bit of googling, and it said that learning to play a brass instrument improves. Lessons to snoring. So
I think my wife might be interested now in giving me a trumpet. Hearing that,
I tried to claim it on my medical card, but I couldn't.
You are such. This has been remarked on many times, but when I was reading The Guts last night, I was just loving what you do with dialogue. You're a master of dialogue, and I was wondering if you could read just a bit from early on in The Guts. There's a scene where Jimmy is telling his three sons about his cancer diagnosis. Could you read that little bit for him?
Yeah, he's talking to his two older sons, and he's brought them up to the bedroom for a bit of, I suppose, privacy, because the two younger children, he wants to tell them separately and differently. The three of them stood in a huddle between the radiator and the bed. The boys were taller than Jimmy now. He felt like the kid. "Don't worry about this," he said. "It'll be fine." He looked from face to face. "I've got bowel cancer." They stared at him. They were waiting for the punchline, but they knew there wouldn't be one. Jimmy was the world's biggest bollocks. What he'd done was illegal, or it should have been. The boys were still waiting to be rescued. "So," said Jimmy, "so I wanted to tell you, Jesus, lads, I'm sorry about this." "It's cool," said young Jimmy, and that saved Jimmy. He could go on. "It'll be grand," he told them. "It'll be a bit, I don't know, inconvenient. For a while, just." "It's cancer," said Marvin. "Yeah, that's not inconvenient, Dad." "Yeah," said Jimmy. "Yeah, come here." He put an arm around each boy's shoulders. He had to reach up to do it. He felt himself going, falling over, but they held him. "I'll be grand," he said. They were stiff there, angry, frightened. Jimmy was talking right into the side of Marvin's head. "It's not the worst of them," he said. "The cancer's like. And we found it early enough." "What's that mean?" "It's confined," said Jimmy. "It hasn't spread, you know." He could feel the boys trying to control their breath, trying not to push away. "It can be beaten," he said. "How?" said Marvin. He was the stiffest, the angry one. "Well," said Jimmy, "chemo and surgery." "What's chemo?" young Jimmy asked. "Chemotherapy." "I know. What is it?" "Chemicals," said Jimmy. "I suppose that's the simplest way to, I don't know." They were still clinging to one another. He wanted to sit down. "They nuke the bad cells, the chemicals, you know, basically." "Sounds good," said young Jimmy. "I'm looking forward to it," said Jimmy. "It'll be like going mad in a head shop." The boys tried to laugh. "I'm really sorry about this," said Jimmy. He let go of them. They seemed to expand, to rise above him. He wanted them back, but he sat on the bed. They stood there in front of him. They were awkward, polite, lovely, and separate. They stood like young men who didn't really know each other. They waited for permission to go. "I'll be grand," said Jimmy.
That's Roddy Doyle reading from his new novel, The Guts. Roddy Doyle, of course, author of The Commitments, among many other wonderful novels and books. That's so touching, but I want to ask you about how you compose dialogue like that. Just because you're so good at it, and I just hear, I imagine you sitting in a pub in Dublin listening to the way people talk and sort of recording it? Or
no.
How does this come together?
I sit in a pub in Dublin maybe once a fortnight, once a week, and I talk to friends and I listen to them because they demand answers or whatever. It's called, it's conversation, you know.
Right.
I'm sure it exists on this side of the Atlantic as
every
well.
Every now and then. Yeah.
I don't go around with a recorder and I don't eavesdrop. I've always enjoyed listening to people because of I love words. Mm-hmm. For example, I love listening to, say, Polish people or African people who are living in Dublin using the English language and putting in the little idiosyncrasies and the little, you know, colloquialisms that we in Dublin use and making them their own. Mm. I get great satisfaction from that and I often look for opportunities to use it. But I don't recall, I'm sure I've done it once or twice, but I don't actually recall ever hearing a line said on a bus or in a pub or at home. Hmm. And saying, oh, that'll go into a book. You know, I just make it up as such. And for that particular passage, for example, I found it easy enough to do insofar as I imagined myself with, I have two sons, you know, Jimmy has three, I have two. They're both taller than me. That gave me the physical characteristics. And then trying to tell them this news, broken sentences, you know, clutching at anything at all to try and make it easier for them. Mm. Joking about it, which would be characteristic as well. Not just of me, but I think of a lot of people who live in Ireland. So it's trial and error.
Yeah.
I write too much and then I pare a lot of it away.
It's so interesting because it's what's not there that is somehow so powerful. I mean, you use the word broken sentences and I'm just amazed how in reading your work, the action, the movement, the story comes through, and yet it's so much of it is built around this kind of fragmented dialogue.
Yeah, I think the trick is if you have two broken sentences that somehow they knit into a different type of sentence so that it's not meaningless. So that if we transcribed a conversation between the two of us,
yeah,
if we put it down on paper, probably it would look like gibberish, you know, because you'd be lacking the eye contact, you'd be lacking the facial gestures, the hand movements and things like that. So the trick is to try and knit the broken sentences, which are the stuff of most conversations, actually, when you listen to people.
Yeah.
And just try to make them more sense. So it's a heightened form of what actually happens. And that's where the work comes in, if you like. That's where when people say, oh, it must be easy, it's not. I mean, that's not a complaint, you know, but it's labor.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's time consuming.
It's fine. I mean, when you read it, it sounds like it's just sort of rolling off your tongue.
Yeah, well, that's the hope.
That's the hope.
Yeah.
It's interesting because people have made comparisons between you and Joyce because of the way you use dialogue.
I thought it was the fact we both wore glasses.
Might also be the fact that you're both from Ireland. But is there something about Ireland and writing about Irish characters that make the use of dialogue so central?
Well, we talk a lot. And I mean, I, you know, if I'm on a bus in Dublin, there's no silence. Well, silence doesn't exist anywhere. But it's conversations and half conversations, people talking to one another or talking to people on the phone. And you get on the tube in London, for example, a city I really like. No one talks to one another unless they're friends.
Yeah.
But strangers never say a word to one another. Whereas in Ireland, it happens. And that's not advocating Ireland as the place to go. I'm not, you know, talking on behalf of the tourist board or anything. But there is a casual nature to it that invites a lot of talk.
Yeah.
And people just, you know, they never shut up, really. So there is that. I've actually just proved that thesis. I've forgotten completely what the question was.
No, you answered it. We started talking about James Joyce and you,
but
I think your answer was terrific.
Yeah.
So I want to ask you a little bit more about Jimmy Rabbit, because we met him 27 years ago in The Commitments. And I'm wondering, when you wrote that or when you finished writing it, did you have an idea that you'd still be living with this character and writing about him more than a quarter of a century later?
Not at all, no. When I was finished The Commitments, I wrote a book called The Snapper, and he's in that book. He's a peripheral figure because it's about his sister and his father. And another book then about his father. And again, he's in that because he's still living in the house. After that, I decided, no, that's enough of that. And I went off and wrote different books for the next 20-odd years, I suppose. But somebody pointed it out to me. I wasn't actively aware of it myself. Of the 10 novels I've written, only one stands alone, the one that won the Booker Prize, Paddy Clark, ha ha ha. I've never gone back to him, but I do go back to other characters.
Isn't that interesting?
I've never, I don't try, you know, there are no dead bodies on the floor when one of my books is finished. Life goes on, tends to go on. So the first time I decided to do this was when I'd finished a book called A Woman Who Walked Into Doors, I think I finished it in 1994. And 10 years later, Ireland had changed dramatically. And I thought the woman from that book, Paula Spencer, would be a great guide through, if you like, Celtic Tiger Ireland, because she wouldn't be directly getting any gain from it. But I thought it would be interesting to see how she felt about it. So I went back to that character. So they're all available to go back to if I wish.
Yeah.
But I hadn't given... I suppose when you're 20, I was 28 when I finished that book. You don't think ahead to what you're going to do when you're 55.
Yeah, yeah. Do you identify with this? I mean, do you identify more with the younger Jimmy Rabbit versus the Jimmy Rabbit that you've just described in The Guts?
Well, I suppose because a lot of the material in the book is not, it's not autobiographical, but I suppose it's inspired by getting older, by watching your children get older, by actually realizing that, you know, your children are taller than you and how awkward it is to hug them sometimes. And, you know, there's a sense of, you know, a lot of people would know what I'm talking about. There's a sense of redundancy for a while because you're not driving them around the place and you have to reinvent yourself as a father if you can do. So I used that stuff, those emotions rather than events in the book. But I recently was involved in a musical of The Commitments, which is on in the West End of London at the moment. And I wrote the script of that. And I reread the book for the first time in a long, long time and wrote, you know, these lines were there. And I felt it as much at home with the younger version as I did with the older version, really.
It's interesting.
Yeah, and it was a nice feeling because I suppose when you get older, you wonder, is it possible to write from the point of view of youth anymore? Or, I suppose I've answered that question myself several times over the years, you know, because I've written from the point of view of women, I've written from the point of view of younger men, older men, whatever. So the challenge is finding the words.
You mentioned the fact that The Commitments is now a musical. It's on stage at the Palace Theatre in London. Initially, you were disinclined to let it be turned into a musical, right?
Yes, yeah.
And what changed your mind?
I suppose I calmed down, really. The Commitments in Ireland, when the movie was released, it was a monster, you know, which was great. It was fantastic. But it just, to my mind, emotionally, it outstayed its welcome. You know, I was sick of hearing Mustang Sally, you know. And
sorry about that. We couldn't resist.
I've come to hate that song with a passion that, you know, I've lost all passion for everything else in my life except my hatred of Mustang Sally. So I turned my back on it.
We thought we were being so original.
Yeah, yeah.
Along with half the world.
But I suppose so. I wrote more books and I was involved in more movies or whatever. And I began then, you know, years later, when my two boys were old enough to watch The Commitments, I began to feel proprietorial again. And it became for a while with them and my daughter, we'd go across to London, maybe go to a football match in the afternoon and a show in the evening. And I hadn't seen a musical before. I associated musicals with The Sound of Music, which is up there with Mustang Sally in the list of things I hate very much. But I went to, say, The Lion King, the musical version of The Lion King. I thought it was wonderful, you know, and I went to The Producers, which I thought was hilarious, and Spamalot, Jersey Boys, I thought was terrific. A lot of shows, I thought, Billy Elliot, some of them were brilliant, some of them less so, but when... There had been more or less constant interest in the musical rights to The Commitments, and I held them. So at one point, I just said, yeah, we'll give it a go. About 7 years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's like an ocean liner. A musical production is like, you know, you start stoking the engine a long time before it starts moving. So we've been planning it for about 6 years.
And how do you like it now that you've seen it on stage? And
I absolutely love it. I was happy to turn my back on it, having sat in on rehearsals for, you know, 2.5 months and then gone to all the previews. So, you know, you go to 2 shows a day on a Saturday, 2 on a Sunday. And that's a lot of repetition, even if you're involved in taking notes. So by the time it opened, I was happy enough to wave goodbye and go home. But I was really thrilled with it. I think it's really, really well done. But also there's an emotional kick as well, that virtually none of the cast were born when I wrote the book.
Oh, boy.
And I think that's great, I think. I'm not sure why, but I think it is.
Well, I wanted to ask you about, I mean, living with this great novel, The Commitments, for so long. And, you know, you mentioned how you get sick of songs like Mustang Sally. I mean, one of the details that I sort of read in doing the research for this interview was this funny idea that the number of people that approached you with the understanding that The Commitments was a real band there in Dublin, as opposed to a band that you had made up for a novel.
Yes. Yeah.
I love that idea.
Yes. And
so that's life imitating art, or art somehow becoming real in life, or something
but
like
very
that.
Very sweetly, I was still a high school teacher when The Commitments was released. Yeah. And we organized a screening for the students, bussed them up to the local multiplex, and they saw the film and went home. You know, that was their school day. So I was a hero for about 48 hours after that because I'd orchestrated this. But the day after they'd seen the film, the three lads, you know, long hair, they were in a band, really very nice fellas. They were in a band and they came in and said, "I love the film, sir." And I said, "Oh, thanks very much, lads." And they stood there for a while and one of them said, will you write a song for our band?" They were under the impression that I'd try a little tenderness and
Mustang
and
Sally.
Mustang Bloody Sally.
Oh, that's great. That's great. So tell me about the role that music plays in your life, because obviously it shows up in a lot of your writing. This latest book, The Guts, he's still managing music and involved in the music business. Where does music live in your life?
Well, I don't know if it's any more intense, my relationship to music or with music, than it is with anybody else's, except I suppose I work on my own, so I play it all day, for example, but other people may not have that opportunity. It can become part of my work in that, as you said, music is in a lot of what I do. So that means, you know, going and finding music or listening to it again and again, doing a bit of homework. Whereas if I was an open heart surgeon, that wouldn't be the option. What would we play today while we open up Jimmy Murphy here? You know, Mustang Sally.
Might be pretty good.
So it occupies a larger part of my life in terms of hours and that. But there is something about it. I am a firm believer, as I get older, if I'm thinking about how am I going to, you know, philosophically get my way through the next 30 years, if I'm lucky enough, you know. And I think it's very, very important to keep the channels open between where you are now and where you were when you were much, much younger. And music really is one of those great channels.
Well, that's a nice way to describe it.
Not just listening to the music we listened to when we were kids, but actually listening to the music of kids now and reimagining it as the music that was there when you were kids. Because an awful lot of it is built on top of the music we listened to when we were kids. So that's one. It's a thread right back through my life, and that's one of the reasons why it means a lot to me.
Let me ask you, speaking of threads through your life, you mentioned that you have a background as a teacher. Are you still teaching?
Informally. I work with teenagers, creative writing, but I'm not in a... It's not in a school. It's in a writing centre that I co-founded in Dublin.
And you do work, and you do writing workshops with young people.
I do, yeah.
So why young people? Why not adults?
That's a good question. First of all, there's time. This is the amount of time that I have to do this. And I think getting to teenagers, I think people are frightened of teenagers. They're not frightened. We do work with small kids as well, and small kids are so sweet and so charming. They're not a problem. Adults aren't a problem either, but people are actually frightened of teenagers. It's as if society suggests that teenagers are wasters, that they're dangerous, that they've no morals, whatever. And, you know, having spent 14 years as a teacher and having been a father of teenagers who are now grown up and having had a house full of teenagers, you know, sleeping on the floor, etc., I know that's not the case. I actually love the company of teenagers. I think they're great crack. So,
good writing students?
Well, yeah. They wouldn't be there if they weren't. You know, it's all voluntary. And it's quite... I particularly get great satisfaction from the kids. For example, a Polish kid who might have been born in Poland or born in Ireland but with Polish parents, speaking Polish at home, English in school, the stuff they do to the English language is just fantastic.
Yeah. Sorry about... Okay, so we've got some music coming up, which is announcing the end of the break. Roddy Doyle, it's such a pleasure. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you very
really
much.
Really a pleasure. Thanks. Roddy Doyle, novelist, dramatist, screenwriter. His new book is called The Guts, and he'll be talking tonight at the Brookline Booksmith at 7. You can find more information at radioboston.org. Stay with us. A lot more ahead. I'm Anthony Brooks with Carrie Goldberg. This is Radio Boston.